Chapter 3. Parted beard and fierce mustaches on sentry before the gate of the police compound. Looming very big above the heads, in a red haze of dust, the tightly packed car of the cable tramway navigated cautiously up the Hooman stream, with the incessant blare of its horn, in the manner of a steamer groping in a fog. Captain Wally emerged like a diver on the other side, and in the desert shade between the walls of closed warehouses, removed his hat to cool his brow. A certain disrepute attached to the calling of a landlady of a boarding house. These women were said to be rapacious, unscrupulous, untruthful, and though he contemned no class of his fellow creatures, God forbid. These were suspicions to which it was unseemly that a Wally should lay herself open. He had not expostulated with her, however. He was confident she shared his feelings. He was sorry for her. He trusted her judgment. He considered it a merciful dispensation that he could help her once more, but in his aristocratic heart of hearts he would have found it more easy to reconcile himself to the idea of her turning seamstress. Vaguely he remembered reading years ago a touching piece called The Song of the Shirt. It was all very well making songs about poor women. The granddaughter of Colonel Wally, the landlady of a boarding house. Pooh! He replaced his hat, dived into two pockets, and stopping a moment to apply a flaring match to the end of a cheap cheroot, blew an embittered cloud of smoke at a world that could hold such surprises. Of one thing he was certain, that she was the own child of a clever mother. Now he had got over the wrench of parting with his ship, he perceived clearly that such a step had been unavoidable. Perhaps he had been growing aware of it all along with an unconfessed knowledge. But she, far away there, must have had an intuitive perception of it, with the pluck to face that truth and the courage to speak out all the qualities which had made her mother a woman of such excellent counsel. It would have had to come to that in the end. It was fortunate as he had forced his hand. In another year or two it would have been an utterly barren sail. To keep the ship going he had been involving himself deeper every year. He was defenseless before the insidious work of adversity, to whose more open assaults he could present a firm front, like a cliff that stands unmoved the open battering of the sea, with a lofty ignorance of the treacherous backwash undermining its base. As it was, every liability satisfied, her request answered, and owing no man a penny, there remained to him from the proceeds a sum of £500 put away safely. In addition he had upon his person some $40-odd enough to pay his hotel bill, providing he did not linger too long in the modest bedroom where he had taken refuge. Scantily furnished, and with a waxed floor, it opened into one of the side verandas. The straggling building of bricks, as airy as a birdcage, resounded with the incessant flapping of rattan screens worried by the wind between the whitewashed square pillars of the seafront. The rooms were lofty, a ripple of sunshine flowed over the ceilings, and the periodical invasions of tourists from some passenger steamer in the harbor flitted through the wind-swept dusk of the apartments with the tumult of their unfamiliar voices and impermanent presences, like relays of migratory shades condemned to speed headlong round the earth without leaving a trace. The babble of their eruptions ebbed out as suddenly as it had arisen. The draughty corridors and the long chairs of the verandas knew their sightseeing hurry, or their prostrate repose no more, and Captain Wally, substantial and dignified, left well-nigh alone in the vast hotel by each light-hearted scurry, felt more and more like a stranded tourist with no aim in view, like a forlorn traveler without a home. In the solitude of his room he smoked thoughtfully, gazing at the two sea chests which held all that he could call his own in this world. A thick roll of charts in a sheath of sailcloth leaned in a corner, the flat packing case containing the portrait in oils, and the three carbon photographs had been pushed under the bed. He was tired of discussing terms, of assisting at surveys, of all the routine of the business. What to the other parties was merely the sail of a ship, was to him a momentous event involving a radically new view of existence. He knew that after this ship there would be no other, and the hopes of his youth, the exercise of his abilities, every feeling and achievement of his manhood, had been indissolubly connected with ships. He had served ships, he had owned ships, and even the years of his actual retirement from the sea had been made bearable by the idea that he had only to stretch out his handful of money to get a ship. He had been at liberty to feel as though he were the owner of all the ships in the world. The selling of this one was weary work, but when she passed from him at last, when he signed the last receipt, it was as though all the ships had gone out of the world together, leaving him on the shore of inaccessible oceans with £700 in his hands. Striding firmly, without haste, along the quay, Captain Wally averted his glances from the familiar roadstead. Two generations of seamen born since his first day at sea stood between him and all these ships at the anchorage. His own was sold, and he had been asking himself, what next? From the feeling of loneliness, of inward emptiness, and of loss to, as if his very soul had been taken out of him forcibly, there had sprung at first a desire to start right off and join his daughter. Here are the last pence, he would say to her. Take them, my dear. And here's your old father. You must take him too. His soul recoiled, as if afraid of what lay hidden at the bottom of this impulse. Give up. Never. When one is thoroughly weary, all sorts of nonsense come into one's head. A pretty gift it would have been for a poor woman, this £700, with the encumbrance of a hale old fellow more than likely to last for years and years to come. Was he not as fit to die in harness as any of the youngsters in charge of these anchored ships out yonder? He was as solid now as ever he had been. But as to who would give him work to do, that was another matter. Were he, with his appearance and antecedents, to go about looking for a junior's berth, people, he was afraid, would not take him seriously. Or else if he succeeded in impressing them, he would maybe obtain their pity, which would be like stripping yourself naked to be kicked. He was not anxious to give himself away for less than nothing. He had no use for anybody's pity. On the other hand, a command, the only thing he could try for with due regard for common decency, was not likely to be lying in wait for him at the corner of the next street. Commands don't go a-begging nowadays. Ever since he had come ashore to carry out the business of the sale, he had kept his ears open, but had heard no hint of one being vacant in the port. And even if there had been one, his successful past itself stood in his way. He had been his own employer too long. The only credential he could produce was the testimony of his whole life. What better recommendation could anyone require? But vaguely he felt that the unique document would be looked upon as an archaic curiosity of the eastern waters, a screed traced in obsolete words in a half-forgotten language. Revolving these thoughts, he strolled on near the railings of the quay, broad-chested, without a stoop, as though his big shoulders had never felt the burden of the loads that must be carried between the cradle and the grave. No single betraying fold or line of care disfigured the reposeful modeling of his face. It was full and untanned, and the upper part emerged, massively quiet, out of the downward flow of silvery hair, with the striking delicacy of its clear complexion, and the powerful width of the forehead. The first cast of his glance fell on you candid and swift, like a boy's. But because of the ragged snowy thatch of the eyebrows, the affability of his attention acquired the character of a dark and searching scrutiny. With age he had put on flesh a little, had increased his girth like an old tree presenting no symptoms of decay, and even the opulent, lustrous ripple of white hairs upon his chest seemed an attribute of unquenchable vitality and vigor. Once rather proud of his great bodily strength, and even of his personal appearance, conscious of his worth, and firm in his rectitude, there had remained to him, like the heritage of departed prosperity, the tranquil bearing of a man who had proved himself fit in every sort of way for the life of his choice. He strode on squarely under the projecting brim of an ancient Panama hat. It had a low crown, a crease through its whole diameter, a narrow black ribbon. Imbrushable and a little discolored, this headgear made it easy to pick him out from afar on thronged wharves and in the busy streets. He had never adopted the comparatively modern fashion of pipeclayed cork helmets. He disliked the form, and he hoped he could manage to keep a cool head to the end of his life without all these contrivances for hygienic ventilation. His hair was cropped close, his linen all was of immaculate whiteness. A suit of thin gray flannel, worn threadbare but scrupulously brushed, floated about his burly limbs, adding to his bulk by the looseness of its cut. The years had mellowed the good-humored, imperturbable audacity of his prime into a temper carelessly serene, and the leisurely tapping of his iron-shod stick accompanied his footfalls with a self-confident sound on the flagstones. It was impossible to connect such a fine presence, and this unruffled aspect with the belittling troubles of poverty. The man's whole existence appeared to pass before you, facile and large, in the freedom of means as ample as the clothing of his body. The irrational dread of having to break into his £500 for personal expenses in the hotel disturbed the steady poise of his mind. There was no time to lose. The bill was running up. He nourished the hope that this £500 would perhaps be the means, if everything else failed, of obtaining some work which, keeping his body and soul together not a matter of great outlay, would enable him to be of use to his daughter. To his mind it was her own money which he employed, as it were, in backing her father and solely for her benefit. Once at work, he would help her with the greater part of his earnings. He was good for many years yet, and this boarding house business, he argued to himself, whatever the prospects, could not be much of a gold mine from the first start. But what work? He was ready to lay hold of anything in an honest way, so that it came quickly to his hand. Because the £500 must be preserved intact for eventual use. That was the great point. With the entire 500 one felt a substance at one's back, but it seemed to him that should he let it dwindle to 450, or even 480, all the efficiency would be gone out of the money, as though there were some magic power in the round figure. But what sort of work? Confronted by that haunting question, as by an uneasy ghost, for whom he had no exercising formula, Captain Wally stopped short on the apex of a small bridge spanning steeply the bed of a canalized creek with granite shores. Moored between the square blocks, a sea-going Malay prau floated half-hidden under the arch of masonry, with her spars lowered down, without a sound of life on board, and covered from stem to stern with a ridge of palm-leaf mats. He had left behind him the overheated pavements beordered by the stone frontages that, like the sheer face of cliffs, followed the sweep of the quays, and an unconfined spaciousness of orderly, unsylvan aspect opened before him its wide plots of rolled grass, like pieces of green carpet smoothly pegged out, its long ranges of trees lined up in colossal porticos of dark shafts roofed with a vault of branches. Some of these avenues ended at the sea. It was a terraced shore, and beyond, upon the level expanse, profound and glistening like the gaze of a dark blue eye, an oblique band of stippled purple lengthened itself indefinitely through the gap between a couple of verdant twin islets. The masts and spars of a few ships far away, hull down in the outer roads, sprang straight from the water in a fine maze of rosy lines penciled on the clear shadow of the eastern board. Captain Wally gave them a long glance. The ship, once his own, was anchored out there. It was staggering to think that it was open to him no longer to take a boat at the jetty and get himself pulled off to her when the evening came. To no ship. Perhaps never more. Before the sale was concluded, and till the purchase money had been paid, he had spent daily some time on board the Fair Maid. The money had been paid this very morning, and now, all at once, there was positively no ship that he could go on board of when he liked, no ship that would need his presence in order to do her work to live. It seemed an incredible state of affairs, something too bizarre to last. And the sea was full of craft of all sorts. There was that prowl lying so still swathed in her shroud of sewn palm leaves she too had her indispensable man. They lived through each other, this Malay he had never seen, and this high stern thing of no size that seemed to be resting after a long journey. And of all the ships in sight, near and far, each was provided with a man, the man without whom the finest ship is a dead thing, a floating and purposeless log. After his one glance at the roadstead he went on, since there was nothing to turn back for, and the time must be got through somehow. The avenues of big trees ran straight over the esplanade, cutting each other at diverse angles, columnar below and luxuriant above. The interlaced boughs high up there seemed to slumber, not a leaf stirred overhead. And the reedy cast iron lamp posts in the middle of the road, gilt like scepters, diminished in a long perspective, with their globes of white porcelain atop, resembling a barbarous decoration of ostrich's eggs displayed in a row. The flaming sky kindled a tiny crimson spark upon the glistening surface of each glassy shell. With his chin sunk a little, his hands behind his back, and the end of his stick marking the gravel with a faint wavering line at his heels, Captain Wally reflected that, if a ship without a man, was like a body without a soul, a sailor without a ship, was of not much more account in this world than an aimless log adrift upon the sea. The log might be sound enough by itself, tough of fiber, and hard to destroy, but what of that? And a sudden sense of irremediable idleness weighted his feet. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.